Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:12 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is September 22nd. Well, the stock market was in positive territory today, so unwound at least part of the decline we've seen over the last 2 days. There's still a sequence of lower rally highs, but it's at least demonstrating support after a 10% decline. 10% has generally tended to be a bit of a Rubicon for the S&P. It's something that a lot of people are taught about when they first come to look at investing in the stock market in the USA, then 10% pullbacks are generally considered to be either at the point at which one can step in and start to buy, or it's also the point at which the decision is made about whether to exit positions. Well, we also had triple witching on, well, it's actually quadruple witching on Friday. So we had a lot of options expiring. And then, of course, we're coming up to the end of the quarter. So there was that announcement by JP Morgan last week that there would be approximately $200 billion changing hands over the course of the next couple of weeks as ETFs and funds reweight into the end of the quarter with a view to what's happening in the final quarter of the year. And of course, what does happen in the final quarter of the year is going to be heavily influenced by fiscal and monetary policy. Well, one thing that has been particularly, I think, relevant is the almost complete absence of volatility in the bond markets. The MOVE index is still close to all-time lows. It was up a tiny bit in here today, but certainly nothing compared to the kind of volatility we saw back in February and March. When we then think about the VIX index, it wasn't able to hold its advance yesterday, and then it came back down below the trend mean in here today. So the pop on the upside that we saw at the beginning of the month has not been sustained, and the index is back below the trend mean. So this is suggestive that we're not about to see a big sell-off. So then, of course, what about all the fear? There has been a lot of concern about the political impasse, the reluctance of the Federal Reserve to provide additional stimulus urgently, and then there's the breakdown of the discussions about fiscal support from the US government. So all of those factors have contributed to the pullback that we've seen over the course of the last 2 weeks. But the reality is that interest rates are going nowhere. There is virtually no prospect of the Federal Reserve raising interest rates until they see the whites of the eyes of inflation. So that's obviously a consideration. Then, of course, there is the additional way of thinking about this, that governance standards have been declining in the USA. I don't think we can really start to appreciate just how much that has occurred. But when we start to look at the intransigence that the political parties have towards one another, and then the politicization of the coronavirus, and then also the fact that this presidential election is going to be hard fought, the outcome is probably going to be quite close, and then the outcome will be fought over in the courts for months after the election. These are all points of uncertainty, but it virtually ensures that monetary policy will be made available in the event that we do have a more substantial pullback. It's quite likely that what we're seeing right now is a clear reflationary trade that's beginning to gain traction. When, for example, we look at what happened with GE over the course of the last week, it popped on the upside last week in on the news that there is going to be a profit in the current quarter. And then it pulled back rather sharply over the last 2 days. So the ability of these big industrials to not just occasionally pop on the upside, but then hold their gains and then push on to new high ground is going to be the deciding condition on whether there is in fact a sustainable recovery in the wider economy. When we then think about the technology sector, it was leading on the upside in here today. Just looking at Microsoft, for example, it found support in the region of the $200 area and is at least holding the region of the lower side of its range. Apple also rebounded in here today and is now pressuring the sequence of lower rally highs from the peak back at the beginning of September. So we had a reasonably good rebound in technology shares. Tesla's battery day is about to start. It starts in about 10 minutes' time. Elon Musk was on Twitter earlier on today and downplaying the potential for new technologies to be delivered in the short term. In fact, he was saying that it may take upwards of 2 years. He was also saying on Twitter today that Tesla needs to start becoming independent in terms of producing its batteries, because inside its gigafactories, Tesla assembles the battery packs, but it's Panasonic develops the battery cells. And Tesla needs to start doing that on their own if they're going to be truly independent. Then let's just think about what could they potentially be ready to announce today with a view to mass producing in 2 years' time? Well, there are two potential candidates. There is the million-mile battery, which I think is probably the most likely scenario because CATL, which is one of Tesla's suppliers, has already announced that it is capable of manufacturing these batteries. So that basically solves the issue with batteries losing their value after only a couple of years. And that is a massive bonus for any company that can deploy these batteries because it removes the loss of resale value that these electric vehicles t generally have. Tesla has got the highest resale value because because they're fashionable and because there's a clear demand dominance for them in the short term. But as the number of cars increases, then that is the big argument about the resale value of the car will rest in the battery. So that's something urgent that they do need to bring to market. I think it's the most likely scenario. But then there's potentially the solid state battery. Dyson failed to bring forward their electric vehicle, and part of the reason was because they thought that they had solved the solid state battery riddle, but they had not been able to bring it to mass production. So that's something that Tesla may have solved, or at least think they've solved. If they have, well, then that will help to solve a number of the challenges for electric vehicles. When we think about what those challenges are, one is range, the other is the speed of charging, and then the other is the sustainability of the battery. So the million-mile battery is the sustainability argument, but then it's range and the speed of charging. And of course, then there's the inherent safety of the batteries as well. So we've got three and perhaps really four important characteristics to the future of the sector. So what Tesla does in fact announce is likely to have a quite significant impact on the share price, but it could potentially be revolutionary for the automotive sector, or it may not be. And then, of course, manufacturing, as Elon Musk himself has said, is incredibly difficult for these new technologies. And that also suggests that the timeline of 2 years might be ambitious because solid-state batteries in particular have had a lot promised and very little delivered, and the lead time for mass manufacturing has always been 2 years. If Tesla's ambition is for 2 years, then I think some degree of skepticism would have to be incorporated into any kind of estimates. So technology does still have the potential to surprise and to provide solutions to intransigent problems, and it does continue to benefit from extraordinarily low interest rates. And then, of course, we have the IPO sector, which is doing even better. It did not pull back in the same violent manner as the the technology sector generally, and then it has pushed on through above the $50 area in here today. It's only been above that level twice, and now it is doing better again. So there is certainly still demand for early stage companies, and that's also a factor for interest rates. Somebody did ask a question in here today asking about whether it is still a viable strategy to hold bonds versus equities in a portfolio. And the historic reason for holding bonds is because they tend to rise in value when there is stress in the economy, and they are an anchor in terms of providing a solid cash flow in normal times, while then you can get capital appreciation and potentially a yield from the equity portion of a portfolio. So that has been the historical relationship. Well, with interest rates close to zero, then bonds take on momentum as the primary way of providing a return. But they then become extraordinarily sensitive to interest rates. So inflationary pressures are likely to rise eventually, but perhaps not quite yet. We're still in an environment where there is a large number of people that are unemployed, and that is something that is going to take time to repair. And we've had a significant transition in terms of the economy. There will be businesses that will not open again. They have been outcompeted by online businesses. But there are plenty of others that will start to open up again. And that's particularly true of the restaurant sector. Once we eventually get through the, the mania of the coronavirus and the approach to it, then that is, I think, one of the sectors that will start to recover again. When we then think about the airline sector, well, they are likely to go through a lengthy period of consolidation, but air traffic will recover. In fact, we booked our first flights in months yesterday because the USA Fencing, which both my daughters are fencers, they put on a limited number of tournaments. If the kids want to, and assuming, of course, that the national championships will, in fact, take place next year, then they are going to have to start going to tournaments. I've been looking progressively and really trying to assess the risks from breaking quarantine. But I think, you know, I have to at least look at my personal experience and then look at the real data that's coming through and look at where the risk factors are. I've always conducted my life in trying to look at where risk in fact resides. Before I got married, I spent most of my vacations diving with sharks. I never really understood why most people were so afraid of sharks, because it's an incredibly exhilarating and informative experience, and the fact that the vast majority of shark species are afraid of bubbles means that it's very rare that divers are attacked, and rather you generally tend to have an extraordinarily pleasurable experience with what are incredibly intelligent animals. And that experience has also informed my way of participating in markets, and trying to buy on weakness is a part of that as well. But then when we look at the kind of mania that is taking place with regard to the coronavirus, then we know that the vast majority of people who are dying from it are of advanced age with pre-existing conditions. The healthcare sector is in a state of crisis because some portions of it, most particularly intensive care and emergency services, are overworked, and the rest of the medical profession is underworked because people are cancelling elective procedures and their annual checkups on a wholesale basis. So then hospitals are very much incentivized, whether it is simply to fudge details or to follow the prescriptions from on high, to exaggerate the number of and the severity of the number of deaths and cases. These are uncomfortable conversations to have. Then when you have, for example, Boris Johnson in here today, and the headline really does say it all, that he's warning of many more virus deaths introducing an additional lockdown in the UK. Well, that's obviously something that is very real for a lot of people, and there is very little anyone can do about it, only that we don't have much choice but to comply. So how are these politicians going to eventually admit that they're wrong? Well, they're not going to do that. So they're almost then certainly going to wait until we have a vaccine. That will give them the cover they need to say, well, the risk has been abated, and therefore we can now go back to our normal lives. It actually doesn't matter whether the virus, the vaccine works or not, or whether in fact the vaccine is more dangerous than the virus itself, but it will be used as a way to reduce the number of prescriptions on economic activity. And that pretty much means that when we roll into 2021, the primary focus of governments is going to try and get people to forget about the coronavirus, and that suggests that there's going to be a very significant reflation trade. So when we look at, for example, industrial resources, copper prices were quite volatile yesterday, but then recouped much of the decline in here today, and most importantly, continue to hold the $3 level. When we think about the London Metals Index, then it has also pulled back over the last 24 hours, but the most important thing it's done in years has been to break the downtrend. So it does suggest that investors are looking at the potential for reflation. Of course, you have got Jerome Powell also saying that the trajectory of recovery is very uncertain, and he is very clear in attempting to try and get the political establishment to sign up to additional stimulus, because fiscal stimulus going directly to people is more effective than the kinds of monetary phenomenon that the Federal Reserve is engaged in when interest rates are already at zero. Then we've got the fact that the yield curve spread is still locked in a range. So the bond market is behaving as if we've already got yield curve control, regardless of whether the Federal Reserve is in fact doing it or not. And as long as that spread is holding below 70 basis points, well, then we're likely to be in a negative real interest rate environment overall. And that's something that continues to act as a tailwind for gold. Now, gold prices overall have been falling for the last 2 days, and they're back testing this $1,900 level. One characteristic that is particularly relevant with gold is that it is best bought following reactions, and it does have reactions. It's just that when it breaks out of what are often lengthy ranges, it tends to surprise on the upside, and that creates a great deal of enthusiasm, and people rush to buy on very firm pricing, and then tend to get shaken out when it has bouts of volatility. Gold is a volatile instrument, and it tends to overshoot on both the upside and the downside. And there's the potential that it could complete this reversion to the mean in a rapid fashion. It's certainly not beyond the bounds of possibility. We also have to at least consider, where are the stops right now? And if we look at the the pullback yesterday and the fact that it found support in the region of the lows put in mid-August, then the lows are, there has to be at least some stops right below the low from yesterday. If the $1,900 level fails, then it's likely we're going to get a little step lower to come back and test the region of the trend mean. There will be a lot of commentary crying out that the gold bull market is over, and that will then likely be a very clear entry opportunity. So this is a very interesting market right now, and I think patience will be rewarded. In fact, in the big bull market up from the lows in 2000, patience was invariably rewarded. Silver prices were steady in here today, but certainly not rallying in a dynamic manner. And if we simply look at this on a line chart, then it has broken down from this range. So it was only intraday rebounds held the lower side of the range back in August. I think that we can be pretty much assured that we're going to have a volatile market overall. The commodities sector is volatile, precious metals are volatile, and then they don't spend a lot of time trending in a consistent manner. It's when they break out of lengthy ranges that we get these extraordinarily impressive advances. Well, the important point, of course, is that we just had one of these incredibly consistent, impressive advances. And that means that we're now in a more volatile environment where buying the dips is likely to be a more fruitful exercise. That's also one of the reasons why I remember David was very active in baby stepping silver back when it was trading in the region of about $4 to $6 in the early 2000s, because he was sure that it would eventually break on the upside, but that it could be very volatile in the meantime. And he was looking for a way to manage his contango costs because he was spread betting. But what it also really does suggest is when we get accelerations on the upside, it's a good time to start thinking about taking some money off the table. And when you get the big pullback, then that is the time to deploy some of that additional cash as well. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.